Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Cohen's Corner. We are very excited to be joined today by a special guest, Anthony Rivera. He is a lifelong Mets fan and a host slash producer of the Subway to Shea Mets podcast, which some of you may have heard. It's one of my favorite Mets podcasts to listen to for sure. And so, Anthony, we are so excited to have you on, and thank you so much for joining us. We can't wait to talk Mets with you, kind of dissect the last week. I know the Mets have only played like 3 out of 6 games, so it's felt kind of sparse, but still excited to dive into all things Mets with you today.
Elizabeth, Jake, I'm happy to be here. Let's actually get some games going on finally. Can we get like a rhythm going?
I know. I'm sick of these off days already. It's like, it's so funny because we go through the whole off season without any baseball and you get used to it. And then there's one off day during the baseball season and no one knows what to do with themselves. I'm like sitting here twiddling my thumbs, watching other games, you know, trying to fill my time.
We have the rain delay. I mean, we have the rain out, and now we're going to Colorado, and it's going to snow.
Oh, my God. I was joking earlier that if Jacob deGrom throws a no-hitter this weekend, it should be called a snow-hitter because it'll be in Denver. So
that's perfect.
You know, if that ends up getting kind of put on a T-shirt one day, I hope to receive my share of the credit. But I don't know. Maybe I'll make the T-shirt and then give myself credit. But anyway, Anthony, so I guess we'll just start out talking today. Something we like to ask our guests, you know, just get a sense of where people's Mets fandom and their baseball fandom came from. I guess we'll just start out by asking, you know, how you first became a Mets fan, how you first came to love the team. Everyone has kind of a different story. So I'm curious to hear kind of what your Mets origin story is to say.
It's crazy. It really didn't even have to begin with baseball at all. My parents used to take me down to the marina, and sometimes we would go at night around Shea Stadium. And obviously, if you're there at night, you see the neon lights. And I was always attracted to those neon baseball lights. Like you had, I guess they had the catcher, they had the pitcher, I guess they had a runner too. I always would think of like Mookie Wilson when I would see that. But like, yeah, that always like attracted me to that stadium, and that got me a little interested in it. And then, you know, as I got older, I started wanting to watch baseball. I played a little bit like right around like 98, before Mike Piazza came. That's when I really started getting into baseball and watching the Mets. And everybody was a Yankee fan, so.
Yeah, late 90s, I mean, they were kind of, I guess until the Mets were good in the late 90s, but, you know, the Yankees obviously had their whole dynasty, you know, we've heard about it, the Core Four, all of that, so they were kind of the talk of the town back then.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's a good time, I mean, to start watching baseball. Obviously, like Elizabeth just said, the Yankees were great, they had their dynasty years back then, and the Mets were kind of coming into their own, too, when they had Piazza, and John Olerud was really good for them in the late 90s, and obviously they made the World Series and lost to the Yankees in 2000, but they were very good in 99, and that was kind of just a good time. I wish I was old enough to remember it, but that's a good time to be a Mets fan, I'm sure.
Yeah, with Piazza, that big, like, obviously now, like the Lindor trade, people are comparing it. I mean, we'll see where it comes down the line. But that Piazza trade basically changed everything for the next 3 years. Because then they had some down years like 2002, 3, 4. But that 98, 99, 2000, and somewhat of the 2001 team really changed a lot, especially with the infancy of interleague play. So you got to see the Mets and the Yankees play each other a lot more.
Famous Subway Series. Yeah. 97 was the first year.
Yeah. And if that whole beginning of the Subway Series from like 97 on, like it's kind of lost its luster a little bit right now, especially if the teams aren't good at the same time, it kind of takes away from it. But like 98, 99, 2000, both teams were in the playoff hunt. Obviously the Yankees are the Yankees. You know, the Mets are trying to make the wild card, and you know, the bragging rights were big then, very big.
I still feel like the Subway Series, I don't know. It may not be, again, I wasn't really following baseball in the late 90s because I wasn't really old enough back then to remember, but I still feel like the Subway Series, I've actually never been to a Subway Series game, but my friend from home and I have always talked about wanting to go just because, I don't know, it would be really fun to just feel the energy of all of that New York energy from both sides in the same stadium, which isn't something I've ever felt. So I guess kind of on that similar note, I know you were talking about the Piazza trade from that time. Did you have any kind of, or I guess throughout your life as a Mets fan, have you had any like really particular favorite players that you loved rooting for? Either kind of, you know, marquee players that everyone knows or maybe more under the radar guys that sometimes get forgotten?
Yeah, underrated. I don't know if he was underrated. He was definitely a defensive wizard. Rey Ordóñez was like my favorite shortstop. And this was like right before Piazza came in. He would make all these plays. Like he could play from second to third, basically. And he would get everything. And then, you know, you put Alfonso at second, you put Ventura, and then you have the greatest infield with John Olerud. Definitely Ray Ordóñez was my guy before Piazza came. And then like that whole time, Piazza was the main guy. I've gained a lot more respect for John Olerud and what he did. He was a very solid first baseman, and he hit for average. He had a little bit of pop. He was very good in the playoffs. I feel like if we would have had him in 2000, I think they would have had a better chance of winning the World Series. No offense to Todd Zeal, who played decently, but it was definitely a different change losing Olerud that year. Then like in the 2000s, late 2000s, I'd go David Wright was my guy. Always. You know,
he's not. I mean, he's everyone's guy.
Yeah. And when it came down to the contract of who they're gonna keep, Reyes or they're gonna keep Wright. To me, it always was you gotta keep David Wright. I felt like at the time when they signed him, I felt like he was gonna stay healthier longer, which obviously did not work out with the spinal stenosis that he had. But nowadays I got to go Jake. That's a thing again. Like, how do you not go Jake? I've never seen anyone in my lifetime pitch the way that Jacob DeGrom pitches ever. And he's just amazing. I think someone posted, I don't know if you guys ever follow Pitching Ninja.
Yep.
A lot of videos out
he's
there.
A regular on there.
Yeah. I don't know if he posted it or somebody else, but it was a comparison. They were like right on top of each other of Jacob DeGrom and Pedro Martinez in sync pitching. And it's like wow. One fluid motion, no, like nothing changes. And it's just one fluid of both of them throwing it together. We're like witnessing right now something out of this world. Like I never saw Seaver pitch. You know, I never got to see Doc Gooden pitch, especially for the Mets. And those two guys like changed the generation. And I feel like Jacob is like our generation now.
Yeah, I agree with you. And not that Mets fans take it for granted, but we're witnessing like a generational talent. You said it. He's not only just for the Mets, but all across Major League Baseball. Like he's one of, if not the best pitcher of this generation. There was Kershaw. And then when Kershaw faded off a little bit, DeGrom kind of took the reins. And over the last, 3 years mainly, he's been the most dominant pitcher in baseball. But even since he came into the league in 2014, he's been an incredible pitcher. And I just don't think he gets appreciated enough. And obviously it sucks that the Mets can't score any type of runs for him. We'll have to get into that because that just is so frustrating that he goes out there and makes one bad pitch, if you even want to call it a bad pitch, 100-mile-an-hour fastball that Jazz Chisholm, who he's also fun to watch, turns on it and sends it into the second deck in right field. But other than that, I mean, he was solid against the Marlins, and we know what he did against the Phillies. But it's a shame that the Mets can't score for him, and the amount of games. They've blown 30-something games, I heard Gary Cohen say, for Jacob DeGrom, and Mets bullpen doesn't ever help matters, that's for sure. But it's just frustrating to see for a pitcher that's as good as DeGrom, and I just feel like he doesn't get as appreciated as he should.
Yeah, he had that one mediocre year in 2016, and that's – coming off of an injury, like
he missed almost all of September that year, I think.
Yeah, we didn't even have him for any type of playoff run or playoff game. We had to rely on Seth Lugo and
Robert Gzelman, who's still here.
Yeah,
that was Syndergaard took over and he pitched that great wild card game that they lost to Bumgarner.
But the thing about Jake is his age. Like he's 32, getting close to 33 now, and he's throwing 103, 104. Like
maybe, yeah. I'm not sure if he's gotten quite that high, but I would not put it past him to. If he touches 103 this year, we're going to be hearing about it for sure.
But like this is, and this is definitely the time that these guys would start. You would start seeing the decline. But since Jake started so late pitching, because originally he was the shortstop, since he started so late pitching. You know, he could, and he's, I think he mentioned this week that he wants to pitch into his 40s. I could see that happening. And he's the type of guy that even if he loses velocity on his fastball, I could see him being able to adjust. He seems like that mentally that he's able to adjust to any circumstances.
Yeah, he's a pitcher. He's not just a thrower. He knows what he's doing out there. He's very – as sharp as he is physically, he's just as sharp mentally. And he's able to – you can tell because mid-start now, he's able to correct himself, a lot of self-correction on his mechanics or whatever he's feeling that isn't right. And I know a lot of people go back to that start he had in 2017, maybe it was.
Oh, that famous one with Terry Collins, like, consoling him in the dugout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and ever since then, I mean, it's kind of like a switch is flipped and he's become this – incredible dominant pitcher that he showed flashes of at times, but now there's just no let up from him, and it's just amazing to see. But I agree with you, Anthony. I think even when a few years from now, when he does lose some velocity, that he's such a good pitcher and he knows what he's doing out there that he'll still be able to locate great, and that slider will still be sharp, and I think he'll use his changeup more. He's going to do whatever he needs to do to be effective, but I don't see him having any problem being a dominant pitcher into his late 30s and even early 40s.
When he came up, I mean, he only threw 94, only 94, when he first came up in 2014. That's the thing. And he had great years in 14 and 15, not throwing 100. So, you know, now that the league has seen him throwing 100, 101 every start, who knows if he ever loses some velocity, would it be easier for them to adjust down? I'm not sure. But, you know, we've seen him be a really effective pitcher, obviously not throwing 101 miles an hour every game. So, yeah, I mean, you know, everyone, I guess, who's listened to this knows that Jacob DeGrom, definitely my favorite Met. Not only now, but like of all time. I don't know if anyone's going to top him. He's just incredible. So,
and he might go down that route. Like, I feel like he needs one more Cy Young to, you know, then we're taking it to another status. I would love to see him get 19, 20 wins, one season, like of 19, 20 wins. Can we get one of those?
Oh, just a lopsided record. You know, one of those like classic pitching lopsided records, 19 and 4, something like that.
1.90 ERA.
That still looks good.
That's what I'm saying about the run support. It's so frustrating that he's usually 1-2 games above 500 at year's end usually. And he's got an ERA well under 2.5 almost every year. And he gets no run support. When a few years back, Jason Vargas for the Royals had like an ERA in the fours. And he won like 19 games that year. Just that's why wins are just so irrelevant.
And yeah. I think what frustrates us so much is we know how talented this offense is. And I think every time he comes to the mound, they press even harder. And then if they don't score, now the bullpen comes in and they even press even harder than that. And that's why we get him losing, you know, 1-0 games, or, you know, then the bullpen will blow the game later on. If he doesn't have like 3 or 4 runs, like the team seems to like fall apart behind him after that.
Maybe he's too good for his own good. Like, you know, that's if he were slightly less good, maybe they wouldn't be so worried about scoring for him. I don't know. That's probably not how logic works.
Well, what's the record? What is it? Like the 36 and 42 since 2018?
He has like a 2 ERA in that time.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Like they got to get their stuff together. I know Brandon Nimmo mentioned it in a press conference that like Jake's the like – prototypical every man, every day guy, and just he's the team player. You know, he's gonna get you through what he can do, but he's not gonna like go after you guys if you know, if they don't score a day. I'm gonna make sure that we have a chance to win every time I'm on the mound, and that's it.
And he always blames himself. He like the other day he gave up that one run. He's like, I shouldn't have made that one pitch. I made that mistake. That's on me. And obviously he's a pitcher and totally different, but he reminds me a lot of David Wright, the way David Wright would handle himself in a post game, and he would never put the blame on anybody else. He was always accountable. He was there after every game to answer every question, and he was like the model citizen. He was built for New York. You can't have a guy in New York that's going to fold under the bright lights and not want to talk to reporters and all that jazz, because it's just not going to work. So I feel like every start, no matter what, DeGrom's always there, and whether he made one mistake or he made 10, it's always on him. He always puts the blame on himself, which is great, but we all know it's really not his fault when he's given up one run and the Mets can't score anything off the Miami Marlins. So, I mean, he can blame himself all he wants, but we all know what the true story is.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love watching his press conferences, but sometimes after the ones that he, you know, like the one the other day, I try to watch, like, just out of habit, like as many Jacob DeGrom interviews as I can. And honestly, I can't even watch the ones after he loses like 1-0. 'Cause it's just like too hard. You know what I mean? I don't need to watch him like trying to I don't know. It's just, it's hard to watch when, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you know, obviously not that hard, but I don't know. Sometimes I still can't bring myself to kind of watch him. Yeah. Try to take blame for an amazing start that should have been a win, you know, like 8 innings, yet again tying his career high of 14 strikeouts. He got a hit. I mean, he's like three. Also, not to he had their first hit of the season on opening day. He got a hit with the bases loaded. He had another hit the other day. It was pretty funny. Like in his last start where they lost, whatever that one play was where someone hit a fly ball to left field, and then they showed a clip of DeGrom on second base, absolutely like booking it, running to third base to tag up on that fly ball. And I'm like, yeah, you know he's trying to like manufacture that run himself because he knows it's not coming from anyone. He's going to have to steal second, third, and home next time he gets on first base to like score a run, it seems like.
And really, that game, as great as he was in that game and they lost that game, I kind of would have been okay with it if they would have left him in game one for an extra inning. I mean, anything could happen in inning eight and inning nine against, you know, against the Phillies at that in their home opener. But, you know, if he's throwing like 77 pitches, why can't he just do one more? Like, I know later down in the line, we're going to see him pitch a lot longer, but like, I was just like, that game frustrated me a lot more. Cause I think once you take him out, like the other team knows, like now we can get to work.
It's exactly like, I mean, remember, you know, during the World Series last year when Kevin Cash took out Blake Snell from game six, and you heard the Dodgers in post game being like, yeah, we literally felt like a weight was lifted off of our shoulders. And Bryce Harper also said this about the Phillies the other day, but I mean, Mookie Betts alluded to it in the playoffs last year. Mentally, I think one thing I feel like doesn't really get talked about a lot is how those pitching changes kind of affect mentally the other team, because yes, you're bringing in a different pitcher. You're taking out a guy who might be at 100 pitches, but I don't know if it gets talked about how much maybe of a mental advantage that then gives the other team to once your ace pitcher is out of the game. So,
and we don't have a lockdown bullpen to do that. We don't have a lockdown bullpen to say, all right, Jake's out. We definitely are going to go May, Diaz, even, you know, as good as Diaz has been last year and this year, like I still am not 100% sold that he is going to be lights out the entire season. And when push comes to shove on a big spot, that he'll get it done. Like I have to see some, you know, definitely a lot of games to start believing in that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I don't want to go on a rant because I did last week, but still, it doesn't make any sense. It's not like DeGrom is this young pitcher that you're trying to save his arm and he hasn't pitched many innings in previous years. Like, he's Jacob DeGrom.
Yeah.
Let the man throw the ball. And DeGrom can say all he wants. It was a team decision. I don't think so. I think he's just, like we said, he's a model citizen. He's not going to come out and say, yeah, I should have stayed in the game, you know? So he's going to back up what his manager did. But 77 pitches and he threw six innings and he had retired nine in a row at that point. And you take him out. And like you said, it's not like we have the Yankees bullpen where it's like a shutdown bullpen where we have all the faith in the world that our guys are going to get it done. It's not like that. Like Castro that night was pretty shaky. Trevor May, shaky. Aaron Loop comes in, first batter, got Bryce Harper, drills him in the arm. So, I mean, like you said, our bullpen's just not at that point.
It's thin. It's a few guys. It's like four guys deep. And then if they're not available, I'm scared, basically.
I'm scared regardless.
I'm scared with them, but I'm also scared with them.
I'm confident in Diaz right now. But there isn't any other pitcher in the bullpen, considering Lugo's out right now. I like Castro, but there isn't one pitcher that they come in and I'm like, all right, I don't got to worry about this inning. This inning's locked down. There isn't one guy in our bullpen that gives me that feeling.
Yeah, and like you, Elizabeth, like you mentioned with like Cash and Snell in the World Series, like I'll get over game one. Like I'm over game one already, the whole DeGrom mix-up. But if like we're in the World Series in a game that we must need and we win, like, and if I'm DeGrom, like I don't know how he is personally, but I'm like, don't take me out. I'm not coming out. Like, stay in there. Stay in the dugout because I'm not coming out. Like, they needed that game. The Cash will never, I don't think, recover from that game.
Until the Rays win the World Series. Yeah.
And I'm not sold on Rojas either right now.
No,
and
not at all.
If something like that were to happen in a big game, he would totally lose me. Like, it's hard for me. I'm rooting for him. I'm rooting for him to succeed. He's come up through the organization. He's been a manager in the organization. But listening to his press conferences has been really rough. Some of the answers that he comes up with just drive me nuts and make no sense to me. I feel like he's being force-fed a little bit. And this is a guy that has a pedigree in baseball.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It's like, mean, there's a lot of managers now, and I think Kevin Cash is definitely one of the main culprits, but a lot of managers today are puppets for the front office. They're
not making all these decisions that we're seeing, for sure.
No, 100%. Definitely. And or even that last night when Rojas pulls Peterson.
Oh, that confused me.
80 pitches. That doesn't make any sense to me, because you bring Familia in. He goes 3-0 right away to JT Realmuto, ends up walking him. He can't get out of it. Aaron Loop came in, and thank God Loop did the job this time. Very happy with what he did. And, yeah, it worked out. So hopefully it does work out more times than not. But that was the most dominant I've seen David Peterson. Like, obviously, he just came up last year, but that is by far the most dominant I've seen him. And I was at the game, and I was with my dad, and we looked at each other. We're like, there's no way, right, that he's coming out of this game. And we're like, oh, well, with Rojas, I guess you don't know. And sure as shit, they pulled him out. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they were taking him out to bring in Jerry's Familia, who we all know what Jerry's Familia is at this point. He's shaky at best. So that that didn't make any sense to me. Coming off a doubleheader where you used a lot of pitchers in your bullpen, I thought you'd want to conserve more pitchers. I don't know. It worked out. So
yeah, true. There'll be games where it doesn't work out. I feel like, yeah, I personally am not going to dive too deeply into the game. They actually ended up winning 5-1.
So. You know what I mean, though? Like, yeah. It's still a questionable decision. Yes, it worked out, but I feel like that doesn't mean that he made the right decision.
It's still setting a precedent that could not work out in the future.
Everything is, like, systematic. 6 innings, that's it. 7th inning, we're going to bring in the first reliever. Then we're going to bring in the setup guy, and then we're going to go the 9th and go in the closer. What happened to letting the guy go 7 1/3 or 8 2/3? Letting him go until, you know, we can visibly take him out.
Yeah, like Girardi yesterday. Girardi left Wheeler in for, what, 100, almost 110 pitches? And I that's why I love Girardi. He's such an old-school manager. And Wheeler was throwing the ball well, and you could tell. And the Phillies have just as shaky, if not more so, of a bullpen than we do. So, I mean, it made sense to leave him in. But that's what I want. I want a little feel.
Trust in your elite pitchers. I mean, David Peterson's still young, but trust when they're going right. I would love to see that more throughout the season. I mean, yeah, we saw DeGrom go 8 innings that they ended up losing 1-0. I mean, I was shocked to see him out for the 8th, frankly. I was like, this feels like the Wild West, seeing someone throw an 8th inning. But I mean, yeah, that I hope to see that more throughout the season for sure.
Well, you talk about DeGrom being mentally strong. I think we got something in David Peterson, one of those pitchers too. He may not get the innings this year, but I think he is going to be a solid back end of the rotation, more than Matt's was. I think his mental makeup is a little bit better than what Steven Matz was. And now Steven Matz is flourishing right now in the Blue Jays.
Yeah, good for him, though. You know, it wasn't going to happen. I don't think – I think the Steven Matz era has just ended in Queens, frankly.
Some people need a change of scenery, and I think he was one of them, and he's really benefiting from it.
Actually, so kind of on that note, or I guess on a different note, but so Anthony, I know I wanted to talk a little bit about your own podcast, Subway to Shea. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of different kind of Mets podcasts out there, and, you know, everyone has their own reasons for wanting to start one. I know, you know, Jake and I were really excited about starting Cohen's Corner not too long ago. And I know Subway to Shea is also kind of fairly new in, you know, the podcast verse. So I'm kind of curious what initially inspired you to actually start this podcast that you now, you know, are doing really fantastic work with week in, week out.
Yeah, like you mentioned, you know, everyone has a med podcast right now. And I think the only way for us all to succeed is by doing these things and promoting each other. So, you know, even like the smaller podcasts like we have, if we, you know, retweet each other's podcasts, just even like articles that you guys have to write, like if we're sharing this stuff together, that's what the Twitter should be for us to, you know, converse. And because we're all, it's really one big Mets podcast family. So we all should be, you know, helping each other out some way. But for me, when I got started, I originally wanted to do more of a historical podcast. You know, I wanted to go back in time with more Mets history, because there's a lot in the now, what are we in the 60th year of the Mets now?
Yeah, I guess, right? So.
And I wanted to do something like that because, you know, following them week by week, day by day, that's like, you got to really keep up with it. And I wanted to do more like a history thing where maybe someone can go back and listen whenever they feel. And you could really reuse those type of episodes. But then I came across, I don't know if you guys have checked out Mets Rewind. Mm-hmm. They are very comprehensive on Mets history, and he does great podcasts. He's got his website. So I was like, ah, I'll stay away from doing more of the historical thing. And then once Steve Cohen kind of like signed on board, I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll take a try at this. It's a new regime.
It's a new time, it's fresh. And I really got into doing this after the first couple of weeks. It just kind of became fluid. And, you know, you came on with me. I think you were my first guest, actually, Elizabeth.
Was I really? Like in January, right?
Yeah, right when they got rid of the GM. That was like
the Jared Porter situation. I remember it well.
Yeah. So, and then just keep going, keep trying to get, you know, different writers and different people on the show and just follow through with the week-by-week basis of Mets. We haven't had so much to go off of because they haven't been playing as much, but it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, and your stuff is amazing, and obviously, as Elizabeth said, you're doing great work, and it's nice to see you're growing. And like you said, I consider all the different Mets podcasts as one great big family, and you're right, we should be supporting each other, and I'm really glad that you were able to come on today. And I'm just curious, so obviously you have great ties to Shea Stadium, and that's one of the main motivations behind your name, Subway to Shea. So what, can you take me through some of your favorite memories that you have going to Shea Stadium? I know you said about being outside and the neon lights, but what about any games that you went to at Shea? Because on past episodes, we've touched on some of our favorite games we've attended. So I'm curious as to games you've been to that you have fond memories of.
There's always three games that come to my mind anytime I think about Shea. Obviously, the first game ever. When I was a little kid, I went with my father. And I think it was the opening weekend of the Mets. And Masato Yoshii, I don't know if anyone knows that name. Masato Yoshii was making his major league debut for the Mets. He was like the big Japanese import that they got at the time. And I think they won either 5-0 or 7-0. And that was like, that was my first experience. Then I went to the 2000 playoffs, game 3, the Benny Agbayani home run. That was by far the craziest atmosphere that I've ever been a part of. And it was just so cool to see Barry Bonds go back and just stop and have to take a look. And as soon as you see the ball go down, it's like slow motion sometimes. Some moments you could just capture in slow motion. And as soon as that ball hits and everyone just jumps in the air, it was that play. Like Shea Stadium was electric. It really was. Like people say that you could feel the stadium moving. That's no joke. They weren't lying when they said that. And then the other game was 2006 Subway Series. It was the ESPN night game. And that stadium, I've never seen a raucous crowd. Like, you know, the playoffs is one thing. But a Subway Series with, like, Mets and Yankee fans there, like, arguing, going at it. Like, I've never seen a wave so cohesive before. And I think that game, both teams were, like, leading in the division too. Like eventually the Yankees and the Mets won the division in 2006. But I think they were down 2-0. Carlos Delgado hit a 3-run home run to give them the lead. And then David Wright comes up after him and literally hits a bomb like out of the stadium. I've never seen a ball hit that far before. And I'm pretty sure there's been guys who've hit monster shots, but this one, I think just like cleared Shea Stadium. Like that's a Piazza thing. He clears the stadium. But those three games always I hold close to my heart.
That's awesome. I remember I guess I really started going to, I've been to definitely way more games at Citi Field than I actually ever went to at Shea, but I have a really fond memory of a game. We went to like Mike Piazza's, I think it was his last home game or his last game at Shea in 2005. I don't know if there's a chance you were at this game. Yeah. Were you actually? Okay, because unless I'm misremembering, who were they playing that day?
Because they were playing.
Was that the Rockies? Might be a different game.
Yes.
Okay.
They're playing Colorado.
I have like a vivid memory of a Mets game from 2005 that I think was this one. They lost like 11-3 or something. They hit like 3 solo home runs and lost like 11-3. And I think that was Mike Piazza's last game at Shea Stadium. So, hey, I guess we were both there. It seems like.
I was there for that game. And then I was also at the David Wright, which was a lot more emotional.
Oh, that felt like a funeral. I was at that game too. And I was crying. I felt like I was at a funeral.
I don't know if you guys feel this way, but anytime these guys leave the Mets, I always feel like they do it the wrong way. Like Piazza left, he still had an opportunity to have one more at bat, but then they take him out so he could get a standing ovation at the end. And I'm like, the fans are going to stay anyway and give him an ovation at the end of the game. But they put like in like Mike DeFelice, the backup.
Nobody wants to see I remember him.
And then like David, he hit the pop out that like everyone booed whoever that first or third baseman was. That
Peter O'Brien.
Him. Yeah.
Hate that.
And then they take him out like in the fifth. I get it. You know, the fifth inning, number five. But it's like one more. Just, you know, let him get three at bats. This last game.
Yeah, I don't know. I was pissed when they didn't let him play that whole game because they went around. They sent him on TV. They sent him onto the radio. They sent him – he made all his rounds. And then me and – I had two friends with me at that game, and they weren't really Mets fans. They just went with me. I had a couple extra tickets. They went with me. And I remember it was like the 12th inning. Like it went the extra innings.
Yeah.
And I think like Austin Jackson hit like a walk-off double or single or whatever. And they're like, come on, can we leave? Can we leave? And I'm like, no, David's talking after the game. We're not going anywhere. If you guys want to go, you can Uber home. I don't know how you're getting home because I drove that day. I was like, no, we're not leaving. So we stayed that entire time. I think it went like 12 or 13 innings.
Yeah, I think so.
And then right.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that game ended until like 12:31. And I like took the train and I'm like, we got to get going here. Yeah. He's still got to talk at the end.
Yeah.
But it was still such a – that was a sad day, that one.
That was so sad. But I agree with you about Shea Stadium. That place used to be rocking. I mean, I got to go there a lot of times when I was younger. And probably the last really good game I went to was in 2008, the last season. It was a back-and-forth game between the Mets and Marlins, and I think Jose Reyes, he had at least one home run in that game. Cody Ross had two. He used to kill the Mets.
He was one of those Mets killers from the mid-2000s. He and Pat Burrell used to kill the Mets in the mid-2000s. Yeah.
So that it was a really good game. It went back and forth. Eddie Chavez tied the game in like the ninth inning with a home run. He never hit home runs. And then Fernando Tatis, he ended up hitting a double down the line. I think Beltran and Wright scored to win the game. And it was just like a wild, crazy game, and that's like the lasting memory I have of Shea. Literally, you're right. The place is rocking. You could feel it.
So. Those guys that always kill the Mets, sometimes the Mets sign them and then they still kill them.
Yeah, they're horrible.
Just inversely, yeah.
Yeah, Wilson Ramos. Wilson Ramos used to kill the Mets when he was at the Nationals. And he was all right his first year, I guess, with the Mets. But last year he was atrocious. And now he's leading the league in home runs. Like, is the most Mets thing ever.
Do you see the change now? Like, I know he hasn't been hitting, but look at the change with the pitching staff with – McCann behind the plate and even Tomas Nito to some extent. Look at those two guys behind the plate compared to what Wilson Ramos was doing. I've never focused in more on a catcher than I did last year with Wilson Ramos. With all the pass balls, I mean, he couldn't move.
He couldn't tag anybody out at home plate.
Yeah.
He's slow doing
that. He cost them so many games with not being able to tag, throwing out to second, he couldn't catch the ball. His framing wasn't great either.
Not even great. It was horrible.
Yeah.
But no, I agree with you. And McCann he hit that home run last night, which is great, and he'll hit. But you're right. The difference that he's had with the pitching staff, and even right when he came in his initial press conference, you could tell that he really takes pride in his defense, and he cares a lot about the relationships he builds with his starting staff and all his pitchers. But, yeah, it's been great to see. And I love Nito. Nito's a great backup. I think he's never going to be a starter, but he's a solid backup. But
yeah, Tomas Nito is a fantastic Twitter follow, by the way. Yeah. I don't know if he posted something today about him like doing a slip and slide during the Mets rain delay. I don't know if you guys saw that video.
Yeah, the ground dared him.
I was like, Jake better not be okay. If Jake like throws out his shoulder, slip and sliding, I don't know. It'd be a great video, but there'd be a riot
if Jacob DeGrom did that. Nobody cares that Tomas Nito did it. Love you, right. Tomas, but nobody cares. I mean, we're happy about it. But if DeGrom did that, I think all Mets world would be losing their mind.
Yeah, I got an alert off like a Bleacher Report alert, like Mets having fun slipping, sliding.
And you're like, no!
That's my first thought. My first thought is like, please don't get hurt. I hope nobody got hurt.
Yeah, I think it was all in good fun. But yeah, no, he's been hilarious. Ever since like the whole, I don't know, he just posted very funny things. Or even on like the night that Lindor's extension got signed, he had some funny replies to Taiwan Walker being like, I waited half an hour for this. And then he responded below. He's like, never mind. And it was like a heart or something. He's just very funny. I feel like, I don't know, it's funny how these like, kind of like we were saying, these backup players, or I just feel like the Mets have so many fun, likable players on their roster. Yeah, even guys like Tomas Nito, who doesn't play every day. He's just like a backup player, but fans still grow to love them because, especially when they have great personalities, that can really go a long way, especially if all these fans are following you on social media, that to just rooting for you even more and, you know, not being mad when he's in the starting lineup instead of McCann or whatever, because people are still rooting for him just because they like him as a person. So that's always fun to see.
Well, yeah, you got the big rah-rah guy and, like, Pete Alonso. He's always going to be, like, the LFGM and pumping everybody up. You got, like, you know, you got the professional in Francisco Lindor. Always guys having fun in Jeff McNeil and Brandon Nimmo. And, like, I feel like the linchpin to the team is Dom Smith.
Yes.
I feel like
Dom Smith batting third, I love it. Yeah. I hope that stays.
They definitely have to keep that. And I don't know why they moved Conforto up there. He's been so successful in the number five hole for most of his career. I think he bats over 300 in either the fifth or the sixth slot. I don't know why they moved him back up to third, but he struggles so much there.
No, yeah, he has. He struggled, especially in big spots, it seems like. Not so this past series against the Phillies, but previous series against the Phillies, it felt like he came up with in so many big spots. Like, he came up with the bases loaded almost every time. And, I mean, usually in the past he's come up in those clutch situations, but he wasn't able to. And I think he'll break out of that. But I agree with you. This team is so fun to watch. I mean, I think this is the most fun I've had watching the Mets since I was a little kid in 2006, like how fun that team was and the personalities they had on that team. And, yeah, it's just a great feel to it. And it really seems – you don't get the feeling with every single team, which is understandable, but you don't get the feel every time that the guys love each other, that they're a great cohesive group. And with this, it just feels different. And you're right about Dom Smith kind of being the linchpin. The other day when Conforto got thrown at – it was unintentional, I guess, but a couple pitches in a row, Alvarado threw up and in on Conforto, and Dom Smith's the one yelling –
John from the dugout, yeah.
Yelling to get that shit down. And I love that Dom's screaming and that he's got that personality. And we saw how everyone kind of came to Dom last year with the Black Lives Matter movement. And when he shared his personal feelings and he was upset during his press conference. And I mean, we love that. We love that he shows his emotion and that it kind of makes you feel like, you know, the player even more when you kind of see them in a raw moment like that. So I think Dom Smith is a really fun guy to root for.
Yeah. And on an even lighter note with Dom, 2019, he's running around in a scooter with a cast on his leg, like in game.
The LFGM license plate on his scooter. Never, don't forget that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's like, I'm okay with him in left field. As long as he's playing, just, he needs to be in the lineup every day. Like, you don't take him out because you want to put in Pilar or, you know, Almora Jr. Those guys are supposed to be late inning replacement guys. The rest of the guys, play them every day. Even Nimmo. And
especially Nimmo. I just like to point out that he's like leading all of baseball in on base percentage right now. And he's batting like .450. So Nimmo, yeah, absolutely.
Anthony, if you didn't know, Elizabeth is the president of the Brandon Nimmo fan club. So
I've been on board since his fantastic 2018 season. I've always been on board the Nimmo train. This year, never. Ever since I left a game early and then he hit a walk-off home run after we left the game, I've been like, you know
that
what?
That Phillies game? You left that game?
Yeah, when he hit the walk-off home run in the 10th inning. Yes, my parents and I were there, and we left, and then I'm on the platform, and I see my favorite player, Brandon Nimmo, like, hits a 3-run walk-off homer. I'm like, bro, like, we did not do this right. And so,
you can't ever leave a game early.
Never again.
We're done with the podcast. We need to cut
that. I'm sorry. I know. I felt really – okay, in my defense, I didn't really want to leave early. I felt bad about it. So that's not happening again, for sure.
As long as you learned your lesson.
I don't understand the people who don't like Brandon Nimmo. The guy's an on-base machine. Like, he's – everyone – Lindor should be leading off. Jeff McNeil should be – no, it's Brandon Nimmo. He should always be leading off. A guy that's going to get on base with a walk, a hit, or however he gets on base – and, like, he sprints out there. He's ready to run around the bases. Like, that's the guy I want out there. He's a hard-working player. And you're the president of his fan club.
For anyone listening, I'm not actually, like, in real life.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
we'll get that started. I would love that.
But I get so much flack for being such a big Brandon Nimmo guy, but I told him, I was like, I don't care. I'll drive that bus and you can hop on whenever.
Thank you. I'll co-pilot.
Yeah. He is, and this whole start has been so good for him. And it even continued on from last year. He's got some kind of hitting streak going on. I don't know this particular stat, but
he's reached base in like 20 consecutive games or something like that. That might be wrong. I'm not sure, but there's some streak going that goes back to last year, I think.
But yeah. And we're going to see a whole lot more of this because now he actually has someone behind him that, you know, the pitchers are going to fear, and as in Francisco Lindor. You know, you have those two right at the top of the lineup. Like you said, Dom Smith, number three. Got to be number three. You got four in Pete. He's going to be the basher.
And then whether you want to flip-flop McNeil and Conforto, that's, you know, I guess that's preference. But as long as those four are not touched in the lineup, I think that's going to be solid. And look what happened. Now they're 3-0 since making those lineup changes.
Yes, ever since Dom Smith moved to the three-hole, they've been unstoppable. So they got to leave him there for sure.
No, they definitely shouldn't. Yeah, because Dom Smith is just – yeah, he hits home runs and hits for power. But even a couple times this week you saw, he just came up and hit a single, hit it through the middle. Like, he's also a very elite hitter for average. He's not just – your normal basher that's going to go up there and hit 250, 260 and hit a bunch of home runs. Like, he can hit over 300 and still hit you 30 home runs and 30 doubles. Like, he can do everything. And I think Dom Smith is one of the most elite hitters in the National League, if not all of baseball. And I think obviously it was a small sample size last year, but I think by year's end, everyone around baseball will be feeling that way about Dom Smith. Cause he's a great hitter. And I think he's built for that three hole. And this lineup just doesn't have any let up to it. And that's the thing we were talking about with McCann. It's okay if he's not going to hit as much, because there's so many guys around him in the lineup that are phenomenal hitters. And especially when JD Davis comes back, the lineup will just get even that much better. Although I do like Guillorme, but the lineup is just, it's the best lineup they've had in so long. Like I said, it's probably since 2006, it might even beat that lineup. Like, it's just, there's no let up in this lineup. You get rid of one guy and there's a great guy coming up right behind him. So,
yeah, even when
I haven't had in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, Jake will remember. I was like bashing Jonathan VR the other day when he came up and they put him in instead of Guillorme. And I was like, oh, we got VR up with the game on the line. And then what happens? He hits a walk off. I'm like, all right, I'll eat my words. That's fine. Even Jonathan VR came through. So whatever. Good for him.
Keep doing that. If he keeps coming through, keep throwing that shit.
That's what I said. Exactly. I texted her. I said, keep talking shit. I like
it. And then the next game, he's still in there and he hits an RBI single. I'm like, all right, yeah. You know what? I might have been wrong about Jonathan VR. Maybe I was too harsh. I don't know. But. You know, yeah, even these role play, even these, like, you know, role players, and the fact that they have guys like that who can come through. Nito hit, this was one of my favorite moments of the week, was Tomas Nito legging out a triple the other day, by the way. Yeah. His first career triple. That was excellent. That was fantastic.
Well, they actually have a bench, like, for the first time in what? For me, this is, like, the first time they've really had a good bench. They had a decent one in 2015, but 2005, 2006, they had a great bench. And, like, these guys, every guy you can rely on. We haven't even seen Amar Jr. in the game yet. Like, yeah. I think he came in as a defensive replacement, but he hasn't even gone up to bat yet. But you got, you know, VR, you got Pilar.
Guaranteed that Ron has been doing this because Keith keeps messing it up. It's Pilar VR. Especially when they're batting back-to-back, it gets a little tough. So, got to watch out for that.
Yeah, and then you got obviously Nitto, and once JD Davis comes back, you know, Guillorme is going to slip back in that spot again as being the all-around utility man. And he already showed what in the last game yesterday, his defensive plays, right? He had such a huge play at third where he snagged the ball, and then Alonso.
Wasn't that the first out of, like, the ninth inning when Familia was in the other game?
Yeah. And then Alonso with the grab too. I mean, it goes both ways. So, yeah, the lineup and the bench is, as long as they hit, I think they'll get out of this little slumber they're in. As long as they, you know, play some consistent games, I think
that's the problem. Fine. They're never on the field. How can you build some momentum and you're never on the field and it's out of their control? I mean, hopefully Uncle Steve throws a retractable roof on Citi Field at some point. I mean, I've been advocating for that.
I tweeted him today. He didn't respond, but I tweeted him the pictures. Have you ever seen the pictures?
I saw that tweet you did. Yeah, like the plans. Yeah,
I think it was around 2002 or 2003 that they had a model of Citi Field with the retractable roof on it. And obviously they ditched it because it was a little too expensive for the Wilpons taste.
Wilpons, yeah.
And, you know, now we have what we have. But, yeah. All stadiums at this point should have a retractable roof.
Yes.
I mean, come on. Like,
they're losing too much money. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why any new stadium, Rob Manfred should come out. Anybody that wants to build a new stadium, fine, but you have to put a retractable roof on it because it's dumb. Like, then you could make it non-postponable. And the teams in the winter, like the Mets, they could host concerts. They could host all kinds of things and make that money back pretty quickly by just hosting events in the winter that they wouldn't be able to host otherwise. And think about that. A nice – instead of it being a freezing cold April night and it's raining, just have a nice roof and with some heat. And you know what I mean? It just makes so much more sense and just make it so much more of an enjoyable experience. And when you're allowed to have more fans back, like when they're allowed to have full capacity, you know how many more fans they're going to draw in early April and late September when it's really cold? I mean, I just think it would make a huge difference.
Well, even they don't even need a full one. They could do what they have out in, I think it's called T-Mobile Park now. Oh, it used to Seattle. Be Safeco in yeah. Seattle. They have a partial roof. Mm-hmm. But I think it like comes out like halfway, but it doesn't just like fully enclose the stadium. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah, I think it can be
done. There shouldn't be any more rain outside. Like how many years of baseball have we all like has been around? And like baseball is always just so far behind in, you know, getting people engaged in the game and pushing out their product, pushing out their players. They're just so far behind. And they think that, you know, putting a runner on second base in like the 10th inning is going to like solve that issue, or, you know, seven inning doubleheaders or pushing the mound back. That's the new one that's coming out.
And the Atlantic League, they're trying that this year, I think.
But there's so many things that they're missing. I kind of feel like the Wilpons are running MLB. Like there are ways to make this sport enjoyable, and they're losing the player. Like we're diehard baseball fans. Like we're diehard Met fans and we're going to watch them, but like you need to start getting some of the casual watchers in there too. And that only brings up revenue if you do that.
You're right. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, baseball is such a wonderful game and baseball fans are super enthusiastic about their sport. So that energy that like the diehard fans are already bringing is really contagious and infectious. So as much as you can do to celebrate, you know, these players that bring so much energy to the sport. I mean, I think we've seen a shift. I think it's been really fantastic actually in the last several years, the shift that we've seen of being more accepting of things like, you know, bat flipping and not seeing every expression of emotion as offensive to the game, but rather just a celebration of how much fun it is. And I think that's kind of a pretty new thing in baseball that we've seen happen over the last few years. And I think that's great. I mean, I love when, you know, when players show emotion and just kind of remind us all that it's a fun game that they're playing. I mean, we see this in other sports. We see in football teams doing whole like touchdown celebrations or, you know, all these like ridiculous things in the end zone. And, you know, nothing really approaching that in the game of baseball that I know of. But I think two things. I think baseball, just celebrating what's already great about it and just pushing that out does a lot. And I think that's honestly enough half the time. But I also think recognizing what announcers like Aaron, Keith, and Ron bring to the TV broadcast and how much they harness combining analysis with entertainment and recognizing that, I mean, the SNY broadcast is a hoot from start to finish. They bring so much production value. And I honestly think because so many people watch baseball on TV, having announcers that are so fun and entertaining and just genuinely have really good chemistry with them, with each other, and also with, you know, field reporters, people like Steve Gelbs, and just with the audience. And I think that does so much for the game of baseball because people are watching it. You know, a lot of how they view the game is kind of colored by the announcers they're watching. I mean, my experience of a game is different if I'm watching it announced by Gary, Keith, and Ron versus ESPN, or, you know, watching the game on Yes Network with the Yankees. So that's something I've always felt is kind of an underrated part of how to grow the game is, you know, have announce, you know, look at the formula that works for the Mets announcers and why they're so beloved and see how that can kind of be applied to other booths. Because I think, you know, baseball has so much room within the game inherently for conversation, and what announcers bring to that conversation is a really important part of how people view the game because they're the soundtrack to it. You know, if we're hearing, for example, like during the World Series last year, I felt like so much of the broadcast between Joe Buck and John Smoltz was just kind of complaining about the current state of the game. And, you know, yes, baseball fans enjoyed the game on the field, but they're also hearing all of this commentary throughout mm-hmm. the game. And that can kind of color your opinion of what you're watching, whether you like it or not. So I think, I mean, announcing is hugely important to growing the game or just keeping people engaged in the sport. And that's something I think, you know, it's Gary, Keith, and Ron obviously are an extremely unique breed, but there's other teams with good announcers too. I mean,
The White Sox play-by-play guy, I love him. He's really good.
Exactly. I was watching a Giants game the other day. The two Giants announcers were really entertaining as well. And so, I mean, that's something interesting. I don't know. I've always thought that especially, you know, broadcasts like national TV broadcasts, I think should definitely examine how to bring in more fans that way. And I think having these really colorful, entertaining announcers that just have such a kind of appreciation for new school baseball, but with like an old school feel just for I don't know. There's just such a special something about kind of these announcers that they're not like stuffing you with analytics the whole game. And they're not just, there's kind of a combination of feeding you interesting anecdotes or just appreciating kind of the quirkiness of baseball that can really, I think, endear people to the sport just with the announcing and having nothing to do with on-field action.
But like doing it the right way, like you said, like how Gary, Keith, and Ron, and I'm not even going to be a homer. I think they're the best. That's the best booth in all of baseball to me. I've listened to the Yankees and I've listened to all these other, you know, commentators, and especially the national guys. I don't think anything compares to Gary, Keith, and Ron. I tried during spring training to watch the ESPN telecast. It was Mets and Nationals, and you know, they're trying to, like you said, they're trying to make it more fun, but it just wasn't working. They weren't concentrate. They weren't paying attention to the game. They were too busy doing interviews within the game. Like they were doing a piece on Juan Soto during the game.
It took up the whole first inning. Playing. I remember that. Yeah.
And they then, I mean, they had the one cool moment where they went to Dom Smith, but like not the whole game. Like I kind of want you to tell me what's going on in the game as well. And then
right, exactly. We don't need the broadcast. Does not need to be a distraction from the game. The game is already great. So just like there needs to be a balance between being entertaining, but also celebrating the product that's on the field, and just recognizing that you don't need all these bells and whistles. I mean, like I said, I love kind of the cute like elements that the SNY production adds to their broadcast, whether it's like the fun graphics they have on the field for like defensive indifference or whatever. I don't know. I love all that stuff.
The Haji stories.
The Lou Brock. Yeah, exactly. When Lou Brock ever gets brought up and they have the Lou Brock.
Or when they read the media guide during blowouts. I mean, I love that stuff, but you have to establish a rapport first. I mean, that's the thing. They are doing that because they know that they have such a great rapport with their audience, and they know that people are going to appreciate it because that's just kind of the nature of Met fans. They kind of appreciate those off the wall moments.
Well, that's the problem with national broadcasts is
right. I
mean, obviously it's going to continue with national broadcasts, but they don't know the team as well as
right.
the home announcers do. And it's not just Gary, Keith, and Ron. It's any team you go to. I mean, it's a really regional network they have in certain areas that they're trying to get their information out to a certain group of fans, and they know that team in and out. When it's a national broadcast, yeah, they know the basic facts, but they don't know these small little inside stories that Steve Gelbs is getting or that Keith Hernandez has to share, that how something now compares to the team when he was on the team in 1986, and all these cool little tidbits that you get thrown in the middle of an SNY broadcast. You're never going to get that really out of a national broadcast. As many experiences as A-Rod's had, I mean, he really can't give you any great insight into something that compares with a previous Mets team to now, you know, like that's just not their thing.
Right.
You can't really blame them. Like they have a new team pretty much to cover each week. So it's a whole different aspect, but you're not going to get that real hard hitting information on a national broadcast that you would with a regional broadcast. And you're right. We're very lucky that we get to listen to Gary, Keith, and Ron every game. And it really, that's what, when you watch a national broadcast, because of how great Gary, Keith, and Ron are, when you watch a national broadcast, it really makes you realize how great Gary, Keith, and Ron are compared to when you're watching a game on ESPN or Fox.
Well, and they're not going to use the term, they're not going to kiss like Mets butt, you know, they're going to play it, you know, straight like they did with
Conforto. They're very critical of the team. Yeah.
Like how angry were they about the whole Conforto situation with the elbow?
Yeah.
And then I think at some point, Gary, I think on the Saturday game, he like apologized.
Yeah, he backtracked. I didn't like that. I didn't like that he apologized for that. I thought I like that, because in what other booth are you going to see where Ron Darling's like, bring it back? Like, there's no way Conforto should be called hit by that pitch. That's got to be strike three. And I mean, a lot of people were really giving the Mets booth a lot of props for doing that. And yeah, when Gary came on and kind of, he didn't fully walk it back, but he kind of said they should have been more on Conforto's side, basically, he was saying. But nah, I love that. And I think that's something that you don't get from a lot of broadcasts. Like if you're listening, and I mean, I just hate the Phillies, but when I listen to their broadcast, it's just like such a homer broadcast. Like when the other team hits a home run,
they can do no wrong. Yeah.
No, but like when the other team hits a home run, he's like, and it's gone. But if another team hits a home run against the Mets and it's like a bomb or like a really nice shot, Gary Cohn's like, it's out of here. Like he gives it a good call. Not as much as he would give if a Mets player were to hit it. But it's not like somebody's dying when the other team hits a home run. You know what I'm saying? Like where there's no emotion whatsoever. And I never am a big fan of broadcasts that only cater to that their one group of fans, that, you know what I mean? Because yes, your objective is to reach out to the Philly fans. Like, that's whose attention you're trying to grab. But that's not the only people watching that broadcast. Like, you got to kind of keep that in mind just a little. Like, yes, you're going to be more on the side of the Phillies, way more on the side, but you can't just act like this other team isn't there, in a sense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think because they have so much clout and history with this team, you know, Gary's been with the team forever. I mean, since like, I think the late 80s, maybe around 90-ish, mm-hmm. Gary came into play. Keith and Ron are, you know, beloved and will be beloved for the New York Mets forever. I think Ron is getting inducted this year into the Mets Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Steve Cohen mentioned that on like the live thing he did with Wayne Randazzo recently. So we'll see. I'm not sure. I don't think he announced like when he'll be inducted, into the Mets Hall of Fame.
Yeah, he's one of three this year that's going to get inducted, along with John Matlack and Edgardo Alfonso. And then they're going to do the Kuzman thing that they were supposed to do last year and retiring his number. And then obviously the Seaver statue. But like I said, those guys, they're so beloved that I feel like if they were to ever, like, the Wilpons really hate bad press and bad media. They had, I don't know if you remember, Bobby Ojeda used to be on the pre and post.
He was great on SNY.
Oh my goodness.
He was fantastic.
He killed the team when they were awful. And then they got rid of him because he did it so much when they were terrible. And I was like, why? We need that. But like these guys that I don't think you could, like, I think it would be like a mutiny. Fans would totally complain about it if they broke up this team.
Right. I mean, it seems like, you know, luckily, obviously they have a great rapport. I'm not super worried about that happening. So, and especially I think Steve Cohen seems to have had a good pulse, at least what fans want, even if he's not going to cater to their every single whim. So clearly I'm sure it's been communicated to him how important the broadcasters are. And he's been watching the games for years too. I'm sure he wants to keep them around just because he's watched games with Gary, Keith and Ron as the announcers. So yeah, I mean, obviously they're definitely the gold standard, I think, for baseball broadcasts. And yeah. And they really just do bring so much fun. I never heard, I think something really unique about Mets games that you don't get with other teams is, like, I've never heard of other teams. Like, when, say, for example, the Mets are losing like 11-0. And you're like, oh boy. Honestly, at that point, sometimes if I'm not watching the game, I'll like turn on the game just to hear what they're going to say. And yeah, that's when they'll start like reading the media guide or playing like the classical music while they're doing something. I mean, I literally will turn on Mets games if they're down by like 10 runs just to like see what Gary, Keith and Ron are going to say. Or, you know, even last year, like, they played a doubleheader on the second to last game of the year and they got eliminated from the playoffs. And I was like, ugh. And then we have another game coming up and they were just eliminated. But I'm like, you know what? I'm going to miss Gary, Keith and Ron too much in the offseason. Like, I got to watch game two. Come on. Like, what am I really doing here? So then, you know, I don't know if you, I haven't really surveyed other fan bases about that, but I feel like it's rare probably for fans to turn on the game if their team's down 10-0 just to hear what their announcers have to say. And that's a respect that's, you know, cultivated over time, but at this, they're at that point where they are so much of an entity that people tune into just as much as the team almost.
Well, it's like, you know, even like they go into extra innings and it gets even better because Keith wants to leave. He wants the game to be 9 innings.
He's got to go feed Haji. Yeah, come on.
Keith's complaining about his the key getting stuck in the door.
Oh man, that was hilarious. His phone goes off and he's like, I gotta take care of a situation. And then Gary's like, is everything okay? And then this whole saga with Haji and the cat sitter. Yeah,
too good.
Anthony, we can't thank you enough for coming on with us today. This has been this is a lot of fun. I know I reached out yesterday saying it was any fun. It was a blast. It was really a blast. So it was great to talk to you, and love for you to let our listeners know where they can find you on social media and what you got going on.
So I'm on social media at Subway Touche. I'm mostly on there. I have a personal Ant Rivera 86, but I don't really use it. I just use it to retweet my podcasts. It's just too much to keep up on. But at Subway Touche, you can follow me on Twitter there. I also have Instagram at Subway Touche too. Haven't really used that as much, but I try to sometimes do a little bit of video. And then the podcast, you can listen to it on Anchor, Apple, Google Podcasts. I think it's on Spotify. You guys know, you're on Anchor too. So all of them, Breaker, Pocket Cast, Radio Public, there's a whole bunch of those things, but mostly on those things. And then sometimes I'll be on YouTube on my friend's network. He
sometimes post my stuff on there as well. HSP Network. You can find my shows there. But that's where you guys can catch me.
You guys haven't gone out and listened to Anthony's stuff yet? Go ahead and do it. You're missing out. So as always, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Cohen's Corner Pod. And you can find Elizabeth at NYMFan97 and me at Giblin_Jake. So we look forward to talking to you guys again in the near future.